You'll be aware that we've started a new series on the theme of apprenticeship. And Paul kicked us off by looking at verses 1 and 2 of 1 Timothy, Paul's first letter to Timothy. And today we're going to be looking at verses 3 to 11. And this series is not so much a verse-by-verse exposition of the letter, but more a reflection on the kind of qualities and activities that make an effective apprentice. So looking at Timothy as the apprentice of the Apostle Paul, and ultimately as the apprentice or follower of Christ. So what we see in this book, and in particular in this passage, is a kind of job description and person specification for somebody who wants to be an apprentice. So Paul wrote to the Corinthians, "Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ." And that, of course, is our theme verse for this year. I'm sure you're all familiar with the fact that an apprentice is someone who learns a trade or a skill by doing it under the close supervision and instruction of an expert or a master craftsman. And the more skilled they become, the more responsibility they take, the more they begin to work independently, and eventually they are recognized as a master craftsman in their own right, and they're able to take on apprentices of their own. And so in this letter, we see Timothy well down the road of apprenticeship. He's leading the Ephesian church, perhaps his first extended solo assignment, but he's still under Paul's mentorship, under Paul's guidance, and Paul is writing to him with a whole series of instructions to help him in his role as the minister at the Ephesian church. And I think it's worth us just spending a few moments looking at the Ephesian church itself. This is it as it is today. One of the great things about the Ephesian church as it's recorded in the New Testament is we get snapshots of it over a 40-year period. So we get several different snapshots extended over a 40-year period. So we know more about the Ephesian church than we do about any other church in the New Testament. And it's worth just spending a few minutes to look at the Ephesian church, because that will help us to understand, not only this morning, but as we go through the series, some of the issues that Timothy was having to wrestle with as the apprentice minister, as it were, at the Ephesian church, and to understand some of the pressures and concerns that he had, and then actually then to relate them to our own day and to our own situation. So this is the city of Ephesus, as it is today. In Paul's day, it had a population of about 300,000. It was the most important city in the Roman province of Asia. It had a large and famous temple to the goddess Artemis, and a theatre that could seat 25,000 people. And Paul visited there briefly at the end of his second missionary journey, around about 52 AD. But the church didn't really get going until Paul's third missionary journey, when he spent about 3 years there between 53 and 55 AD, roughly. And that's when the church really came into being, started to grow and to prosper. And Timothy appears to have been with Paul for most, if not all, of that time. So he experienced the church being planted and starting to grow. At the end, from 55 onwards, Paul spends a bit more time travelling on his third missionary journey, and calls the Ephesian elders to meet him on the beach at a place called Miletus, commends them to God, and says that they're never going to see him again. And then he eventually ends up in prison in Rome, and around about AD 60 writes the Ephesian letter, his letter specifically to the church at Ephesus from prison in Rome. That gives us another snapshot. What happens next is a little bit unclear. It's most likely that Paul was released from prison and travelled between about 61 and 64 AD in some further journeys that are actually unrecorded, more or less unrecorded in Scripture. But it's likely that 1 Timothy was written around about that time, around about 64 AD, so around about 10 years after the Ephesian church was founded. So you got the prison of the letters to the Ephesians around about 60, about 5 years after it was founded. Then this letter to Timothy about 10 years after the church was founded. And then we know in 2 Timothy that Paul's back in prison again, that he knows his end has come, and Tradition has it he was executed under the persecutions of Nero in around about 67 AD. And then the last snapshot we get of the Ephesian church is around 90 to 95 AD, some 30 years later again, and it's referred to in the letter of Revelation in chapter 2. And what you notice when you go through these different snapshots of the Ephesian church is that false teaching and false teachers were a major issue throughout that whole period. So when Paul meets with the elders on the beach at Miletus at around about 56 AD, some 4, 5, 6 years after the church was founded, he says this: "I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you and will not spare the flock. Even from your own number, men will arise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after them." So he warns them about what's going to happen. And then a few years later, writing to them from prison, he says, "Then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming." So the same issue he's dealing with. In verse 3 of our reading just now, Karen gave us, Timothy's urged to stay in Ephesus so that you may command certain people not to teach false doctrines any longer. And then when we go right forward, we fast forward another 30 years to Revelation chapter 2 and verse 2, we read this: "I know your deeds, your hard work and your perseverance. I know that you cannot tolerate wicked people, that you've tested those who claim to be apostles but are not and have found them false." Good news up to that point. It seems like Timothy's ministry, what Timothy worked for, what Paul prayed for, what the elders were warned about, has borne fruit. And this church had resisted false teaching, had identified those who were false prophets, and had resisted them. But there is a downside, and we'll come on to that in a few minutes. Those of you who will know the story will know there's a downside. For those of you who don't, I shall keep you in suspense for a few more minutes. And I want to look on now, if I may, at just four qualities that Timothy needed as an apprentice of Christ in that situation in Ephesus, and then to apply them a little bit to ourselves. We'll come on and look at this gentleman in a minute, but let me just read what Paul wrote to Timothy again. He says this: "As I urged you when I went into Macedonia, stay there in Ephesus so that you may command certain people not to teach false doctrines." You get the impression that Timothy didn't want to stay in Ephesus with that particular job description. And who can blame him? Paul had to urge him to stay where he was. He was inclined. You get the impression he kind of wanted to leave and get out of the situation and get to somewhere more comfortable. Timothy has a reputation for being timid. I'm not sure that's entirely justified, and even if it was, I doubt if any of us would feel any differently if we found ourselves in his situation. Now, you may be thinking this morning, well, I'm not called to be a pastor or a teacher or a leader. I'm not being called to publicly confront false teaching, and that may well be true. But we are all called to be apprentices of Christ, to be his follower. And that, I think, takes courage. It's probably one of the primary requirements to be a committed follower of Christ today. It's simply courage. You know, it takes courage to stay in a difficult situation. It takes courage to stay where you are, where you'd much rather escape or run away. It may be you're in a difficult situation at work or at college or in your marriage or in some other relationship, and you think, I just need to escape. If only I could escape from this situation, it would be so much easier for me to follow Christ and to be a committed disciple of Christ. This is just a really difficult place for me to be. And the temptation is to try and escape and get out of it. Now, that may be appropriate in certain situations, but it may also be appropriate, actually, to stay and not to shift. That God has placed you where you are to be his disciple, his apprentice in that situation, and he wants you to stay there until he very clearly calls you to move. There may be situations, actually, you can't escape from. You know, you, humanly speaking, you are stuck where you are, and there is no obvious way out. And it takes courage not to sink into despair and into apathy and into a victim mentality, into feeling sorry for yourself. That takes courage to resist that and to live victoriously and with hope and with confidence in those kinds of situations. So Timothy required courage in his situation. We require courage in the situations that God has placed us in. Does anybody recognize this particular person? It could have been Roger Bannister. Yeah, it's not actually. A little bit earlier than Roger Bannister. Chariots of Fire guy. I heard somebody say Chariots of Fire guy. You did. That's right. That's Chariots of Fire guy. Eric Liddell. That's the man. Yes, so this is Eric Liddell. Well done. Yeah, so those of us of a certain generation remember the film Chariots of Fire. So Liddell was a Christian and an athlete, and he refused to run in the 100-meter heats at the 1924 Paris Olympics, which is his favoured event, because the heats were run on a Sunday. And so he transferred to the 400 metres instead and won a gold medal. And as a result of that, decades and decades later, the film was produced. He became a missionary in China after the war, where he'd been born to Scottish missionary parents. And he actually died of a brain tumour at the age of 43 in an internment camp, a Japanese internment camp, on the 21st of February 1945. And such was his impact in that camp that a fellow internee wrote, "The entire camp, especially its youth, was stunned for days. So great was the vacuum that Eric's death had left." So here was a man who had the courage of his convictions and held them through thick and thin. It took courage for him not to run on a Sunday. And although he won the gold medal, actually there was no guarantee he would have done so. He could have, you know, not even made the final. And yet, his story would never have been known. Okay. And yet, he held to his convictions. And it wasn't about winning the gold medal. It was about holding to his convictions. And when we hold to our convictions, there's no guarantee that we will be obviously blessed in the way that Liddell was by winning the 400-meter gold medal. But we will be honouring God as his disciples and as his followers. And he was a man who lived victoriously, even under the most difficult and trying circumstances, and made a huge impact with his life. So I'm not here to say today or lay down any rules or regulations about what we should or shouldn't do on a Sunday. It's simply an illustration of a man who had very clear convictions, who held to them, and whom God honoured through them. It takes courage to identify yourself as a Christian and to stand up for what you believe. Tim Fallon, the former leader of the Lib Dem Party, stepped down after the last election, at least in part because he felt that he was compromising his Christian convictions in one particular area. And he felt that he could no longer lead the party and have a clear conscience. You know, and that takes great courage to sacrifice political ambition for what you really believe. It takes courage to sacrifice perhaps a special relationship, to sacrifice a job, to sacrifice money, income, wealth, whatever it happens to be, for what you really believe and what you think is important as a follower of Jesus Christ. It takes courage. I wonder if you remember these six different things here. This was the framework for fruitfulness that we did fruitfulness on the front line. I can't remember how long ago we did that now, about 18 months ago. And we talked about, in fact, we preached through these six different areas: modelling godly character, making good work, ministering grace and love, moulding culture, being a mouthpiece for truth and justice, and being a messenger of the gospel. And that framework is what, as we work and live that out, that's what helps us to be fruitful on the front lines of our lives, wherever those front lines happen to be. But I would say that each one of them, and especially the last two, requires significant courage. It takes courage to be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you for the reason for the hope that you have. There is a time to be silent and just to listen. There is a time also to speak out and to make your convictions and beliefs known. It takes courage. It took courage for Timothy. It takes courage for us in our own situations today. So that's the first quality of an apprentice, the first item on the person's specification for an apprentice of Christ. Here's the second one. It's love, perhaps unsurprisingly, but very challengingly. When Paul was urging Timothy to resist false teachers and to expose them, he is not saying that the goal of sound teaching is sound teaching. It's never an end in itself. The goal of sound teaching is love. So this is what Paul prayed for the Ephesian church, and it's a great thing for us to be praying for ourselves and for one another. He said this to them, "I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power, together with all the Lord's holy people, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God." And he reiterates it when he talks to Timothy. The goal of this command is love, which comes from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. So the purpose of sound doctrine is always love. Let's go back to Revelation. And for those of you who know the story in Revelation, there is a stinging rebuke for the Ephesian church. And this is what the Lord Jesus says, speaking through John, the writer of Revelation. He says, "Yet I hold this against you. You have forsaken the love you had at first. Consider how far you have fallen. Yet I hold this against you. You have forsaken the love you had at first. Consider how far you have fallen." So the goal which Paul prayed for some 40 years previously, that Timothy labored for some 10 years later, was ultimately missed. They had lost or forsaken their first love. So there's a great warning for us here. I wonder how many of you remember, anybody remember the book 1066 and all that? Those of a certain generation, yes, Barbara, yes, you and I do, we remember it, yeah. Okay, it's a kind of witty take on British history, and there's a very famous line in it that says this: "The Roundheads were right but repulsive, and the Cavaliers were wrong but romantic." And I think we can apply that to the Ephesian church. By around about 90 AD, if I can put it this way, the Ephesian church was right but repulsive. They lost their first love. And the false teachers were wrong but romantic. I suspect that these false teachers were very charismatic in terms of their personalities, very clever, very persuasive people. But they'd missed the mark as far as the gospel was concerned. So if you remember nothing else from the service this morning and from the sermon this morning, I want you to remember this. It's our takeaway, that we are called to be right and romantic. Okay, you're called to be right and romantic. So sound doctrine, being right, leads us to love God with all our heart, soul, mind and strength, and to love our neighbour as ourselves. If we do that, if we don't do that, something has gone badly wrong. We are called to hold to sound doctrine, and that sound doctrine leads us to agape love. This is what Augustine said, writing many, many centuries ago in a sermon on 1 John. He said, "Love and do what you will. Whether you hold your peace, through love, hold your peace. Whether you cry out, through love, cry out. Whether you correct, through love, correct. Whether you spare, through love, must you spare. Let the root of love be within, for of this root can nothing come except that which is good." So the goal of sound doctrine is always agape love. We are called to love. We're called to be right and romantic. If that helps you to remember what we're talking about this morning, you take that away with you this morning. So, love and do what you will, said Augustine, writing around about something like about 440 AD. Here's the third quality, conformity, which is an interesting word, isn't it? So courage, love, fourth quality of an apprentice is conformity. An apprentice is someone who conforms to the work patterns and practices of his or her master. And we are to conform ultimately to the pattern of Christ, who is the gospel. Now, in the passage that Karen read for us earlier, there are a whole list of things we are not to conform to. And in fact, Paul's roughly working through the Ten Commandments and applying them to the world he saw around them, where there was murder and slave trading and perjury and lying and homosexual practices of all kinds. And it's a world, actually, that sounds very similar to the world in which we live today. There were people trafficking then, and there are people trafficking now. But the purpose of the law, in that, as Paul outlines it in that passage, is to properly understood, is to show us the standard that we need to conform to and to reveal that we cannot possibly live up to it. So if we truly loved our neighbour as ourselves, at a personal, community, national, international level, then evil will disappear completely, or almost completely, and suffering, though it would still occur, would be greatly reduced. But we simply cannot do it, either at a personal level, at a community level, national level, international level. Every one of us fails to love our neighbour as ourselves. Every one of us fails to live consistently with our own consciences, and to that extent, we sin and we fall short. And Jesus' great criticism of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law was that they defined the law in such a way that it was possible with great effort to keep it, or so they thought, and to declare themselves righteous. And they looked down on everybody else who couldn't keep it, and they were kind of arrogant. And Jesus, in fact, declared that they loaded people down with burdens they couldn't possibly carry and didn't lift a finger to help them. And these people, the scribes and the Pharisees, they focused on external observances and not on inner transformation. And Jesus says that they were like dishes that were clean on the outside and dirty on the inside. And the false teachers in Ephesus, these people obsessed with genealogies and myths and goodness knows what else, were very much the same. They were focusing on external things. They were focusing on the wrong thing. And they were missing the mark for themselves. And they were leading others astray. I wonder whether the Ephesians ultimately lost their first love because they focused on outward conformity, outward observance of the law as they understood it, what it meant to be a Christian outwardly as they understood it, and that produced arrogance and resentment and pride and fear, and that they missed the inner transformation that comes from love. I love the story of Zacchaeus. I was reading it just the other day. And you remember Zacchaeus? He was a chief tax collector, so he was regarded as a traitor to his own people because he was collecting money on behalf of the Romans, taking a share for himself and then passing on the rest to the Romans. So he was short in stature, but he was also short when it came to emotional, spiritual, and social and spiritual stature. So he was little in every sense of the word. And he hears that Jesus is coming along. So because he's so short, he can't see because of the crowd. He climbs up a tree, and it's there in the tree. It's rather kind of undignified position for a man of his background to be. And Jesus comes along, looks up in the tree, and says, "Zacchaeus, I'm going to come to your house today to eat." And everybody mutters and says, "Goodness me, how can Jesus go and eat with this man? He's a traitor, he's a tax collector, he's defiled in every way. He's short, he's small in every conceivable sense of the word." But Zacchaeus' reaction is very different. Jesus comes to his house, and there's this enormous outpouring of joy, joyful generosity. He says, "Here and now, Lord, I give half my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody of everything, I'll give them back four times as much." And Jesus says, "Today salvation has come to this household." See, Zacchaeus didn't say, "Well, Jesus has come to my house, so I better show willing and give something to the poor, and maybe I'll stop cheating for a little while and just to keep up appearances and make everything look good." That would be outward conformity. That would be responding in kind of fear and unbelief to Jesus. But no, there's a completely opposite reaction. There's this abundant outpouring from his heart of generosity, of wanting to put things right and to show how much he loved Christ and how grateful he was for Jesus' love and acceptance of him. came across this quote the other day in The Spectator. That was back in November, actually. And I'll just it's a little long, but I want to read it to you. It says, when Stephen Crabb MP is described in the press as a devout Christian, it tends to be to suggest that he is a bit of a fake. Fancy going to church and then sending sex messages to a woman he'd just met. I don't know anything about the context of that. I'd say this betrays a misunderstanding of what Christianity is about. The whole point about Christianity is that it's not for the perfect, it's for the imperfect, which is why the Catholic Church describes itself as the Church of Sinners. Indeed, Christ didn't seem to like the ostentatious clean livers in his own society very much. He was much more of a tax collectors and prostitutes sort of person. And duly, sinners gravitated to him and have done ever since, on the basis that it's the likes of us who need forgiveness. So that's the challenge for us today. Who or what are we conforming to? Are we conforming? We're all conforming to something, whether we like it or not. We're all conforming to someone, whether we like it or not. Are we conforming to a set of laws and living lives characterized by outward conformity and inner resentment and arrogance and pride and fear? Or are we conforming to the life and pattern of Jesus, the one who first loved us and has forgiven us through his death and resurrection on the cross? That's the challenge for us today as Jesus apprentices. Courage, love, conformity. Here's the final thing for us to think about today, and that's trustworthiness. So at the end of our reading, it says that sound doctrine, it talks about sound doctrine that conforms to the gospel, which he, Jesus, entrusted to me. So Paul writing to Timothy says, Jesus has entrusted to me the gospel. And Paul, in his turn, was entrusting it to Timothy. So trustworthiness or good stewardship. The gospel is entrusted to each one of us, not just to leaders and to teachers. And right at the heart of being and making disciples, right at the heart of being an apprentice, is passing on to other people what we ourselves have received. So I'm passing on to you this morning what I've received in the preparation of this sermon. It's the pass it on principle. And it's based on 2 Timothy 2:2, knowing that his life was coming to an end. Paul said to Timothy, the things you've heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable, that's trustworthy people, who will also be qualified to teach others. Now, Paul wasn't talking about having formal academic or theological qualifications. That's not what he means by being qualified. They didn't have them in those days. You know, the church was completely non-institutional, and it was growing fast. He meant people who were trustworthy, courageous, motivated by love, and committed to conforming to the pattern of Christ, and who understood the gospel. And every one of us can be that sort of person today. Has God blessed you in some way? Tell somebody about it. Pass it on. Have you received an answer to prayer? Tell somebody about it. Pass it on. Have you read something that's challenging in the scriptures? Tell somebody about it. Pass it on. That's what God has called us to do. Now practice the pass it on principle. Share with somebody else something that struck you from the sermon. And that's very simple. That's all we need to be doing. If we're doing that, then we're being good apprentices and we're copying what Paul commissioned Timothy to do in his context and in his day. So this is something that's for all of us today.